This year marks the 50th anniversary of the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution, in which Congress authorized President Lyndon Johnson to do whatever necessary to assist South Vietnam in its struggle with communism. It led to the escalation of the war in Vietnam and a long and bloody conflict that ultimately divided the nation. In this hour of midday, we hear from some men who graduated from an Ivy League college just months before the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution. Unlike many who managed to avoid military service, they were among the millions who served in the armed forces during the long war in Vietnam. The Ivy League and Vietnam, stories and reflections from members of the Dartmouth College class of 1964, on midday after the news. And welcome back to Midday, everyone. Dan Rodericks here. Thanks again for joining us for the second hour of our show today. The Vietnam War officially ended nearly 40 years ago, but its legacy still lives in American politics and foreign policy. The once popular move to intervene in a communist-leaning country in the early 1960s ran into overwhelming opposition in the U.S. and sparked mass and sustained protests from Americans horrified by the casualties taking place in the jungles of South Vietnam. The war divided the nation. One can argue that if it were not for the draft, public sentiment at home might not have reached the level that ultimately forced the withdrawal of U.S. troops from South Vietnam. Draftees numbered 1.7 million, about 25% of the American military force during the Vietnam era. Avoiding the draft into an unpopular war became a ritual for many young men. Some left for Canada. Many took advantage of deferments. While elite students are often thought of as well-connected or savvy enough to have avoided Vietnam, many were called to serve and did so, however begrudgingly. That includes men who were students at Ivy League colleges and universities. The draft ended in 1973 as the war was winding down. Even before the fall of Saigon in 1975, some Ivy League colleges and universities banned military recruitment and ROTC programs on campus. Yale, Harvard, and Columbia did not allow these programs to return to their campuses until 2011. Dartmouth, the elite school located in Hanover, New Hampshire, allowed ROTC to return to its campus in the early 1980s. One of my guests this hour, Philip C. Schaefer, is class secretary for Dartmouth College's class of 1964. He writes a bi-monthly column for the alumni newsletter, each one with a distinctive theme. A couple of years ago, he decided to devote a column to the Vietnam War, as the conflict was taking place while his Dartmouth class was still in undergraduate study. He put out some feelers asking if there would be alumni willing to submit an essay about their experiences in the Vietnam War. After receiving 55 essays, he decided to compile them into a book, and the result is Dartmouth Veterans Vietnam Perspectives, a book that's now out in publication. And we have Phil Schaefer with us on the show today, one of our guests. Phil, nice to have you with us today.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
Bill Riggs was drafted in 1967 and assigned to be an illustrator for the Army Intelligence School located at Fort Holabird here in Baltimore. It's nice to have you with us, Bill.
Thanks, Dan. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, also class of 64, right?
That's right.
At Dartmouth.
Yep.
And rounding out our studio guest, Alan McKee, whose essay Radio Days discusses his time at the Armed Forces Radio in Saigon. Alan McKee, nice to have you with us on Midday as well.
Thanks very much. I'll try to use the microphone right.
Yeah, right, because you learned that back in the day. And we'll also be joined in a little while by Tony Thompson, who served as an Army radio tech in Vietnam, also a Dartmouth 64 graduate. So, Phil Schaefer, let me start with you. I just sort of summarized briefly there how this got started. Were you surprised to get 55 essays back?
Not really. I had a list of about 150 classmates who were in the military. Almost the vast majority of those were in ROTC, which was a vibrant program on campus at the time. And about 70 or 80 of them said that they would write essays, and a collecting 55 out of that number was gratifying, but not surprising at all.
You know, a lot of people of a certain age would know what ROTC refers to, but I feel like when we talk about this era, we have to remind people what that was.
It was the Reserve Officer Training Corps, and many of those students would not have been able to go to Dartmouth without that program being available, because as regular ROTC students, they got scholarships paid for by the government in return for their future military service.
How cognizant were you of Vietnam while you were in Dartmouth, 1962, 63, 64? Were you even thinking about hearing about Vietnam?
It didn't cross my mind at all. I'm not saying that all of my classmates were the same, but I was focused on my studies. I was not a very social person there. I was in the chemistry lab all the time. My knowledge of Vietnam occurred after I finished college. But then the major U.S. involvement occurred after that as well.
I noted in the introduction of the show today that 1964 was the year of the Gulf of Tonkin resolution. Now, that came 3 months after you would have graduated from Dartmouth College. And then you probably became more aware of Vietnam when that happened, when Congress authorized the President of the United States, Lyndon Johnson, to do whatever was necessary to help South Vietnam in its struggle with communist incursion.
That's absolutely correct. That was a big event in American history at the time, and it caught a lot of people's attention.
So, Bill Riggs, let me ask you about that. So, 1964, so you graduate from Dartmouth.
Yes.
Probably not thinking too much about Vietnam.
Not at all.
No one in the country really was. But then we have the Gulf of Tonkin resolution later in the year. And then from there, the escalation of the war, it really took off after then. So tell us about those years before you actually started your military service. 64, 65.
Sure. 1964 wasn't on my radar at all, war in Vietnam. I went on to graduate school in St. Louis, into architecture school at Washington University, and it became more prominent as events escalated in Vietnam, and by mid-1966, early to mid-1966, I would say, classmates then in graduate school with me were receiving inklings that they might be subject to the draft, call-up.
Speaking of the draft, that's something we have to go over, too, because we haven't had a draft since 1973, and some people may not be aware about how this even works, some of our listeners, younger listeners in the audience. So what was your experience with the draft? Did you get a number for a lottery? How did that work?
The lottery came later, after we were came of age, so to speak. Young men became eligible for the draft at age 18, and at the policy then in effect, you were still eligible until you were turned 26, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I remember having a celebration party on my 26th birthday that I was no longer eligible for the draft. Unfortunately, I was already in the Army, having been drafted the year before. But
at 18, you register for the
18,
selective
you register
service,
for the
right?
draft. Mm-hmm. Each city, town had a local draft board made up of local citizens who, through some arcane procedure, decided which of these 18-year-olds they were going to invite to join the
local
the
draft board. Right.
That's right.
So this was sort of always hanging over your head. Al McKee, I'll go to you on this. So while you're at Dartmouth, you're registered for the draft, right? You probably had uncles who were in wars or friends of the family who were subject to the draft earlier, the Korean War, World War II. So this is always hanging over your head that you're going to have to do military service. I'm trying to remember what this was like for men of your age when they were undergraduates in college.
So it's hanging over your head. And so for people like me trying to anticipate the easiest way to dodge the draft, you figure you'd rather be an officer than an enlisted man, and so as a freshman in college, you join ROTC. And I need just to make the point that while the Navy and Air Force ROTC programs in those days entailed scholarships. Those were elite programs, and those of us who joined Army ROTC, I think, got a stipend of $20 or $30 a month. So this was not—we were not on the gravy train, but we—that ensured that we would have a better life when we were actually serving in the military.
Right.
We thought.
Right. So you were anticipating that this may happen.
Right.
Right. But the hope was maybe you wouldn't be called at all, right? Of course.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't really know how to plan. You didn't know what to expect.
You could have played the odds against being drafted. And, of course, once you signed up for ROTC, you were committed to do 2 years of active duty.
Right. Do you have a recollection specifically of Gulf of Tonkin resolution later in the year of 64 after you graduated from college, the possibility that, hey, I could end up in the jungle?
I don't, because I spent a nice summer hitchhiking through Europe. But when, as soon as I entered active duty in December of 65, I was part of a group that was being trained to operate U.S. Army Signal Corps depots in the field, and it was pretty evident what the future had in store at that point.
Phil Schaefer, I want to go back to you, who served as an editor for this book. So this is the compilation of essays by our guests, Bill and Alan, and also Tony, that we'll hear from soon. What struck you about these essays when they started showing up? That people, these men were eager to tell the stories about their experience in that era. First, maybe that was a little surprising, but what did you come away from after you saw all these essays?
What did I take from
the
essays?
Yeah, what did you take from it? Yeah.
Well,
or was there a common theme in them, for instance?
Fine. Well, as for theme, undeniably there was pride of service. These men went in knowing what they had to do. They were proud of what they did, but there was a lot of skepticism elicited after they served. When they came home, they thought a lot about what they had been required to do, and they weren't so sure that it was the right thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
There were ethical and moral issues, and even questions of the tactical maneuvers that were used during the engagement.
Right. You know, I'm thinking about, I was struck by how different the world was in just a matter of a few years. Bill Riggs, we'll go to you. 1964, you graduated from Dartmouth. You're not even thinking about Vietnam. Most of the country isn't, as we've said. Just 2-3 years later, though, this is the height of of a protest in the country. It's what everybody's talking about. There's arguments at kitchen tables. We're in the throes of this war. Mm-hmm. Casualty rate goes up in Vietnam on both sides. I mean, the world changed so quickly.
It certainly did. And it's been said, and I agree, that the 1950s didn't really end until 1963 with the assassination of President Kennedy. And so the 1960s, there was a sea change in the country, and people began to think differently about a lot of things, our place in the world, mortality, rightness of our causes and of our beliefs.
Right.
And so in 1964, that was sort of a distant undercurrent on the horizon. But, you know, it wasn't until 1966 or so that, as I say, we began to feel the approach of something vastly different and more dangerous. We believed that up until that point that our lives were on a smooth and steady track, that somehow the prosperity of the 50s and of our childhood would continue, and that was not to be.
We'll take a little break here, Bill. Bill Riggs, one of our guests in this hour of the show. We're talking about the Vietnam War, the Vietnam era, with three members of the class of 64 of Dartmouth College. The occasion for this conversation, the publication of a book of essays by alumni of Dartmouth College, Dartmouth Veterans, Vietnam Perspectives, edited by Philip Schaefer, one of our other guests. It's published by Dartmouth College Press. This is Midday on WYPR. Short break, and we'll continue our conversation in a moment. And welcome back to Midday. Dan Rodericks here as we continue our conversation. We're joined by members of the Dartmouth class of 1964 who were involved in these essays, who wrote these essays, contributed to a book of essays called Dartmouth Veterans Vietnam Perspectives, which is published by Dartmouth College Press. Phil Schaefer, the editor, was the secretary of the class of 64 at Dartmouth, and we're joined by two of the contributors, Bill Riggs and Alan McKee. And Bill, so I want to go to you. You mentioned Fort Holabird pops up in your biography here, and I've heard a lot about Fort Holabird over the years from men of a certain age who grew up in Baltimore or grew up in Maryland and had to report there for their induction into the Army. So how did you get to Fort Holabird?
I was sent to Fort Holabird after basic training. I was inducted in Cincinnati, where it was near my hometown, and I went through basic training in the summer of 1968 at Fort Benning, Georgia, outside Columbus, Georgia. And at the end of my basic training, I received orders to report to the U.S. Army Intelligence School at Fort Holabird, Maryland. Well, I had no idea where that was, but nor did anybody else in Fort Benning, apparently, but I did find out. And so 2 weeks later, flew to Baltimore and reported to Fort Holabird.
Did you also have an experience at Fort Howard?
I didn't directly, but Fort Howard, the way Fort Howard enters my story is that the intelligence school existed to train the entire cohort of intelligence personnel in the Army, for the whole entire Army. And at Fort Howard, which is located on the Chesapeake Bay right at the entrance to Baltimore Harbor on the north side behind Sparrows Point, there was a VA hospital located. And also on these grounds, which is quite beautiful, really, the Army Intelligence School constructed a mock Vietnamese village so that people who were being trained to be intelligence operatives could sneak ashore. They would land on the beach outside Fort Howard.
And they did trainings of landings?
They did training, yeah. The Army had a boat that they used for landing these people.
And they would, what would they train to do? Practice attacking the village?
Well, it's sort of like the Lone Ranger, you know. You go out and sneak up on the enemies, on the bad guys' camp, and try to learn what's going on.
I never heard that story before.
No,
about Fort Howard.
That's true. So
how long were you here?
I've been here ever since. I mean, I came here in 1968 and was discharged from the Army in 1970. And being an architect by training, this was a good place to stay as the Inner Harbor was growing up. So
before we go on with your story, and then we hear from Alan too, people listening to this show always think, Dartmouth College, Vietnam War, why were these guys even in the Army? I thought everybody got deferments.
Mm-hmm.
I thought they had good connections in their families to keep mm-hmm. them, or maybe they went in the Army Reserve. Anyway, what are you doing? How is it that you end up in uniform during this period? Because there's this impression people have that if you went to an elite college or any college at all, really, that you just avoided this whole thing.
I was impressed by the fact when Phil and I started corresponding to learn that over a quarter of our class served in the military. There were 615 graduates, and I think over 150 of us served in the military. Deferments were easy to get early on. If you were in college and legitimately enrolled and could prove it, people got deferments. They were renewed every year or whatever. And that was my case until I was age 25. I had had the good fortune professionally to spend a year abroad working in Vienna, Austria, 1966-67. And when I came back to resume my education and renew my draft, update my draft status, a whole bunch of us from my hometown were called into the draft board office at Christmas time to explain why we shouldn't all be reclassified 1A, which is a classification for people who are ripe to be inducted.
Right.
And so I went down to the draft board and said, look, I'm a graduate student at Ohio State. just give me my graduate deferment back and I'll go on my way. And there were must have been 50 other guys in the office at the same time. Everybody's screaming and having their Christmas vacation disrupted. And it turned out that in my case, they decided that since I'd already had a year off in Europe and had been, they thought, scamming the system, which I did not think I was doing, they left my 1A classification in place while a lot of my colleagues.
And there was nothing you could do about that.
No, at that point. I mean, I tried other alternatives, but I was not successful.
Alan McKee, you also were class of 64 at Dartmouth. So could you briefly summarize your course into the military after graduation?
Okay, so I was in ROTC, so I had to go on active duty. I was scheduled to go to Vietnam to be part of a Signal Corps unit. And my stars were truly aligned right, because instead I ended up helping run the Armed Forces radio station in Saigon, which was a great assignment, because we had a window on the war, and we were part of the MACV, the Military Assistance Command Vietnam headquarters. So we had contact with the brass from General Westmoreland down. And we had access to military advisors coming in from the field for R&R in Saigon. We had a lot of contact with journalists, the journalists who were covering the war. Mm-hmm. And then we were visited by every starlet that Bob Hope escorted around the world who reported for other interviews, and that was a lot of fun, too.
Including Anne Margaret?
Including Anne Margaret and Walt Kelly and all sorts of people who were too obscure even to come up on the radar in those days.
What was it like in downtown Saigon when you got there? You said you got there in 65?
65, yeah.
Yeah, what was it like in Saigon at that time?
It was a very nice life, except occasionally your quarters were blown up, and that could be painful.
Adrian Cronauer is the name people associate. When you mentioned Armed Forces Radio in Saigon, we think of the film that was directed by Barry Levinson from Baltimore, starring Robin Williams some years ago. I was going to ask you for your opinion of the film, but it's what people associate with that.
Yeah, and that's a fun connection. Adrian Cronauer was an announcer on AFRS when I was there. And what he did was to shop the script for the show in order to raise the money with which he put himself through law school. And Robin Williams was the guy who picked that up.
Alan McKee, how long were you there?
Just a year.
Just
as we
a year.
All were.
So 65, again, this is 66. After, this is 66. This is post Gulf of Tonkin resolution.
Mm-hmm.
It's escalating. It's getting busier. You're seeing more and more troops coming through, right?
Right.
Things are building up. And where did you go from there after that assignment? Did you stay in longer?
I stayed in for a year longer. I was in the 197th Infantry Brigade in Fort Benning, Georgia. So I have a little claim on being a real soldier.
Okay. Yeah, I try to help people appreciate the change that occurred, the big changes. Post-Gulf of Tonkin, escalation of the war, higher casualties, more news reporting of what's happening in Vietnam, more awareness by the public of exactly what's going on there, more television coverage. That's what's happening in this country.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder, from your view, when did things start to change? When did you sense or when did you hear that things were going wrong, that this wasn't working out, this was taking too long, the military wasn't making the progress that that Washington wanted to see?
That was a theme that was evident from the very beginning of my exposure to Vietnam. The military advisors would come in from the field, and there was ready access to them in the officers' dining rooms in Saigon. And I talked to dozens or scores or hundreds of these guys in 1965 and 1966, and every single one of them said, well, I can't see any progress where I'm assigned, but with all the resources we're pouring into Vietnam, of course we'll prevail in the end. But there was a disconnect.
What did you think, Alan McKee, when Dartmouth, I guess, stopped ROTC when the recruiting stopped at the other Ivy League colleges. What did you think of those decisions?
Looking back and looking at the essays in this book, it probably wasn't a good thing. It helps to widen the gap between the civilian world and the military world. And if the military doesn't, doesn't become a political force of its own, as it is in so many countries in Latin America and Egypt and so forth, there needs to be representation in the military from all levels of society. And we don't have that without some form of compulsory military service.
I was going to ask about that today. I wanted to get all of your opinions on that very thing. It's something that I've thought about a lot and actually written about in the Baltimore Sun, and we've discussed on this show. A couple of years ago, interviewed two authors of a book that, who wrote specifically about the Ivy League and military service. The book was called AWOL. And what they were calling for in that was not so much compulsory military service, but for the Ivies to at least talk about it as a career option, for people to think about it as not something that's only assigned to a certain class of Americans, but something that everybody should consider doing in terms of serving their country. Have you thought about that, Bill? What are your thoughts about that?
Well, my experience, I'm going to come at it a little bit differently. My experience was that since we were all subject to the draft, regardless of social station or, you know, economic good fortune, that was a great equalizer, a great leveler. I went through basic training. I'm one of the very few people in the book, by the way, who's so-called enlisted. I didn't enlist. I was drafted, but I was not an officer. So I went through basic training with people from all walks of life, who were many of whom ended up going directly to Vietnam. I was lucky to not to have to do that. But the, at the time that we were subject to conscription or subject to being called up into military service, it was a universal cloud hanging over all of the men of my age. It's different now.
Yeah.
So it is strictly all volunteer, and that's changed the way that I think it's perceived.
Do you think it hastened the end of the Vietnam War, the fact that there was a draft in place until 1973, that more people had a skin in the game? Do you have a thought about that?
I don't think the war ended quickly enough for most of us. One of the things that interested me about the book, and it's in complete sync with my own experience, was how uniformly anti-war, if I could use that term, the sentiments were of the people who responded to the book.
Yeah, Phil Schaefer, the editor of the book, Dartmouth Veterans, Vietnam Perspectives, published by Dartmouth College Press, occasions our conversation today. Phil, so what can you say about that, what Bill was just saying? Is that overriding comments that you got in the essays?
The majority of the essayists found that their experience was beneficial.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the themes that they found that exposed that was their interaction with diversity.
Mm-hmm.
People from different social strata, from different parts of the country, different racial groups. I'm sorry to say that at the time that we went to college, Dartmouth was very WASPish. It was not a very representative environment.
Mm-hmm.
And many of the guys felt that they learned a lot from their experience in Vietnam. Not always a good experience, but they learned from being exposed to different differences. People from different economic backgrounds, social, racial, religious. It was a leveler, and they found that valuable.
You know, I suggested compulsory public service of some kind,
mm-hmm.
giving young people a choice, a couple of years serving your country in the military or in community service, doing something of some kind. And people seem to respond to that. Others took a bad, a grim view of it. And the people soured by our experience in Iraq and Afghanistan in particular don't want to hear about compulsory military service anymore.
I just wanted to say that even without a draft and with only a rudimentary ROTC program, Dartmouth isn't completely AWOL. At the current time, one of the most interesting pieces of writing that has come out of the experience in the front lines in Iraq and Afghanistan is a book by Phil Clay, who was a graduate of Dartmouth in the class of 2005. It's called Redeployment. The New Yorker thinks it's the best writing that's come out of those wars. And there's a member of the class of 2014 at Dartmouth, is a veteran of 6 years as an Army Ranger with service in Iraq and Afghanistan. So this connection between the civilian and military sectors of society isn't completely broken.
You know, as for that Ivy League angle on the draft, the history of the draft in the United States, I read this once and was very impressed by it. When World War One broke out, this goes back to World War One. This goes back 100 years, 1914, 1915, the class of 1914, I think, at Princeton, pretty much emptied out, went down to the draft board and signed up. And Congress took a look at that. Congress concerned about losing, you know, Americans, a whole class, a generation of Americans, of American elite, wanted to do something about that and made the draft more, what's the word I'm looking for, spread the pain around throughout the country more, and came up with a different formula for, actually came up with the draft, a formula for bringing in more a more diverse class of American to serve in the military.
And repeating on that theme, the class of 42, which is the year in which most of my classmates were born, at Dartmouth, pretty much empty out and went to World War II. And they actually put together a book not too dissimilar from this, but the authors were in their late 80s and 90s at the time.
Phil Schaefer speaking there, editor of the book that we're discussing in this hour, Dartmouth Veterans, Vietnam Perspectives, Experience of the Class of 64, Dartmouth College in the Vietnam War and the Vietnam Period. We'll get to speak with another of our guests, Tony Thompson, will be joining us by phone after a short break here. We'll continue our conversation in just a moment. Please stay tuned. Serving in the Army in the middle of a large urban area in a time of such pervasive tension meant that my life and the lives of many of my friends became dichotomous. We were soldiers by day and civilians by night and on weekends. We were educated, we read the newspapers and watched the news, and we were anti-war even as we respected and honored our brothers serving in Vietnam. That's from Bill Riggs's essay, right? In this book of essays called Dartmouth Veterans, Vietnam Perspectives. And we're speaking with Bill in this hour of the show, along with Phil Schaefer, who edited this book, also a member of the class of 64. And Alan McKee is with us as well. His essay is called Radio Days. And again, thank you all for being here today to talk about this. Certainly interesting. We turn now to Tony Thompson, who also has an essay in this book. Tony, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
Tony, you have an essay called An Undergrad in Vietnam. Is that right?
Correct, yeah.
Yeah, tell us about that. Tell us about your experience here and what you wrote about in your essay, would you please?
Surely. I feel a little bit at odds with some of this because our good dean, Thad Seymour, suggested that I take 2 years of out and grow up a little bit. I didn't spend my time like Phil in the chem lab. I really didn't take advantage of Dartmouth's educational opportunities. So I volunteered for the draft in 1963.
And this was a dean's suggestion to you.
It could have been stronger than a suggestion, possibly.
Okay.
But I volunteered for the draft, and if you didn't think you had heard of Vietnam in 64, you certainly didn't hear of it in 63. So I went to Albany, New York, and to the draft. That's where the induction center down to Fort Dix for almost a year, I had orders cut to go to Garmisch-Partenkirchen because I was a skier from Stowe, Vermont, not a very good one, but those orders were changed to go to Vietnam.
Wait. So originally you thought you were going to be what, on a ski patrol in Germany?
Absolutely.
And you ended
I was convinced.
And you ended up in Vietnam.
Wrong airport, right. Tansanut and not whatever. But yes, that was my path. So it was quite a shock. But I didn't know much about it. Read a little bit, Bernard Fall, some books on Vietnam. We were certainly not trained to go to Vietnam or to be in Vietnam. I was an RTO, which radio trend, whatever it is, a radio operator,
radio tech,
assigned to. I was with MAG, which was before MACV, which is Military Assistance Advisory Group, Vietnam. I was assigned to a Vietnamese unit, and I'd been in country for about 3 days and went to the Ashau Valley with one other American enlisted man to, quote, advise, unquote, a group of about 100 Vietnamese Arvin soldiers that were guarding the Ho Chi Minh Trail. In fact, I was in a outpost at the time of the notorious Gulf of Tonkin event, and we were fully prepared to be overrun by the North Vietnamese.
So let me just stop you here, Tony, just for a moment here. You're referring to Arvin, that's the Army of the Republic of Vietnam, meaning you're
correct.
you're with South Vietnamese troops,
correct.
Right?
I was paid by the Navy and attached to the South Vietnamese Army somehow or other.
So this is now, what year is this? Is this
This would be 64. Mm-hmm. I was in the Ashau Valley when the Gulf of Tonkin event took place.
So that was August 64. Okay.
Right.
So please continue.
Well, that was interesting duty for an undergrad in Vietnam. We were totally we went out on patrols with radios blasting in case there were Viet Cong or North Vietnamese around because we were undermanned and whatever. We had infrequent contact with the enemy. And one thing I wanted to say, listening to, I think it was Alan, Perry Mason visited this other enlisted man and I when we were out in this outpost called Alui. I forget what his name was.
Raymond Burr.
And it was one of the highlights. I couldn't believe what an effort. You know, there were two of us. So, but anyway.
So the people who weren't around then remember Bob Hope taking his show on the road with the USO, Joey Heatherton,
right.
Ann Margaret. I forget
exactly.
whoever you would see, Liza Minnelli. They would show up at these events in Vietnam and entertain the troops, and even Raymond Burr.
He came out in a helicopter into the Ashau Valley to visit two American soldiers, which I thought was a whole lot different than the Bob Hope show. But anyway,
there was just the two. Excuse me. There was just the two of you.
Go ahead. Sorry,
Tony. There was just the two of you at the time Raymond Burr showed up.
Right. That was my point.
What an odd story that is. Please continue with your story, though.
After being 6 months in the what we called in the active or operational part of a MACV assignment or a MAG assignment, we would go back into our compounds. I was up on the DMZ in a town called Quang Tri. That's MAG headquarters in I Corps. And somehow or other, predominantly or mainly because I was 19 or 22, whatever it was back then, young man full of, I was very, very powerful, invisible, all those things in terms of combat. I volunteered to take the place of somebody who didn't want to be there with another unit, so I stayed out in the field for another 6 months and was with a Vietnamese unit that was the only unit, as I understand, cited for distinguished conduct during the entire war by President Johnson. It was so I have a much different feeling about the war than most of my classmates. I think I was never anti-war. I never knew what anti-war was until I came back to campus, and then I found out what anti-war was. But I have some pretty strong feelings, and right up to the Tet Offensive, which, had we not lost so many Americans, like I think 3,000 or 4,000, the North Vietnamese were awfully close to coming to the table because they took a terrible beating. But I guess we just had enough at that time. But it made my term in Vietnam, a little, not difficult, but I felt that there were 40 or 50,000 people whose lives were sort of thrown away for political reasons.
What was it like when you got back to Hanover, New Hampshire, the Dartmouth campus? You mentioned that briefly, but a little bit more.
It was tough.
Yeah.
It was tough. I never forget going back to my fraternity and being called a moral coward for going to Vietnam. One of the low points of my Dartmouth career, but you know, people were passionate against the war. And
when someone said that to you, Tony, how did you react? Did you just become angry, or did you try to understand it?
I don't think I was away long enough to be mature enough to try and understand it. It probably hit my anger buttons. I moved to White River and moved off campus and really focused on my studies. And actually, in 1968, I went to Australia and lived there for 6 years. So I wasn't fully exposed to all the things that were going on in America regarding, the war or the anti-war, and et cetera.
So you must have become disoriented, like try to understand what happened to your country in the time that you were away. Because when you went off, things were so different. We were talking earlier in this hour about how different 1964 was from 1967 or 68, just a smidgen,
right.
Smidgen of time. And even further back, 63, pre-Kennedy assassination, what a different world it was from, 4 or 5 years later.
Absolutely. Yeah. And the hiatus I had from America, being in Europe, in Australia, marrying an Australian, I had a child, and I came back to Vermont in 1974, and things were much calmer in the 6 years I was away. They were, it was really the height of the anti-war sentiment. I have a quick thing that I thought might be of interest, and that is that I was involved in a battle in a town called Kua up on the DMZ, and I don't remember how many of theirs were killed and ours were killed. Luckily, I was always only with one other American, so I was never in a position where Americans were dying all around me. But it was a highly successful event, and Cabot Lodge, secretary at the time, ambassador at the time, sent up a man to view the spoils of war. There were all sorts of equipment and bodies, and it was a guy named Tony Lake, who dated my sister back in Connecticut or wherever. And Tony and I had a great meeting, and he gave me the gist of what was reported, and this is purely not speculative, but these are not correct numbers. If there were 50 dead North Vietnamese, he had a report saying there were 500 dead North Vietnamese, and that's why he came up. And what happens is the killed in action numbers from the battlefield through the various channels on their way up to or down, in my case, to Saigon, getting added to it, making it highly terribly difficult for the people trying to run the show to know really what was going on. I'm not saying that happened all the time, but that was certainly one hands-on experience which blew us both away.
That's Tony Thompson, Anthony B. Tony Thompson, whose essay, An Undergrad in Vietnam, appears in the book Dartmouth Veterans, Vietnam Perspectives. What was it like for you at the end, Bill Riggs, when you finished out?
I was one of the ones who, not alone, certainly, but as the war progressed and never seemed to get better. I mean, the pressure on the intelligence service was so great that by the time I got out of the Army, the Intelligence Corps was preparing to move to Fort Huachuco, Arizona, which they ultimately did. But I used to go to war protests in Washington and march in Washington. Again, not alone. There were many of us who did that. Part of the dichotomy I spoke of.
Did you do it as a Vietnam veteran against the war?
No, I was still on active duty at the time, so I just put on my...
You just put on civilian clothes
exactly.
To do that? And Alan McKee, how was it feel when you finished out?
When I left the military service, I went to graduate school in foreign affairs and international law, and that debate was taking place. This is 67 to 69, which of course spanned the Tet Offensive. But this was on kind of a high plane. People weren't marching in the streets or attacking each other as moral cowards. So I, again, had another pretty benign experience.
Yeah, yeah. And Phil Schaefer, who edited the book, Dartmouth Veterans, Vietnam Perspectives, what did the contributors to the book say about the way it finished out for them? Do they express what we heard from Tony Thompson or similar to Bill, Alan?
There was a diversity of opinions and expressions. But now as they look back on it, a lot of them were very uncommitted to the way the war was handled. Some of them came out and were virulently anti-war. I can think of one who actually lives in the area who joined and maybe was even instrumental in forming Vietnam Veterans Against the War. And I believe met his wife at a demonstration, or his future wife at a demonstration.
And are there 55 essays in the book?
Actually, there are 58.
58 now.
But there are three that are not our classmates. One of them was by Robert Hager, a member of the class of 60, who was an NBC correspondent on
right.
the ground. One by the girlfriend of one of our classmates who was killed in Vietnam. And a final one by this member of the class of current undergraduate who was involved in the Iraq War.
Well, very good. Phil Schaefer, thank you very much for being here today. Phil visiting us from New Hampshire, editor of the book Dartmouth Veterans, Vietnam Perspectives, which has been published by Dartmouth College Press. And Tony Thompson, I'm glad you could join us today. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you for listening.
Yeah, thank you. Tony Thompson's essay, An Undergrad in Vietnam, is in the book. Bill Riggs's essay is in the book as well. It's called Rear Guard. Bill, thank you very much and for letting us know about the book to begin with. So
Absolutely.
Thank you very much. And Alan McKee, who lives here in Maryland, it was a pleasure to have you on the show as well. Alan McKee's essay is Radio Days, all published again, Dartmouth Veterans, Vietnam Perspectives. You can find more information about it on the Dan Roderick's Facebook page. Thank you all, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dan.
And thank you, everyone, for tuning in. That's our midday for today. Dan Roderick's here. Have a great afternoon.
Midday's senior producer is Nikki Gamer. The producer and director is Jonathan Ahrens. The associate producer, Michael Himowitz. Our interns are Luke Spicknell, James Daly, Tom Cartaxo, and Michelle Richardson. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming available at wypr.org. Dan Roderick's column appears in the Baltimore Sun. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.